The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buford. Welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast in which we will be taking a journey into history, discussing contemporary events, and even doing some conflict futurism. We'll be examining this violent and calamitous clash and collision between complex adaptive systems armed to the teeth to see who will prevail and see what it tells us about the human condition and why we can't stop. Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 009 of War Notes, a conflict podcast. The title of this one is Fixing Fight Club, Just Say No to NATO. Now, Fixing Fight Club is a series that I put together. Well, it inaugurated War Notes in the first place in order to provide a rather quick yet detailed blueprint for how to fix what ails the American martial enterprise and, by extension, the allies and coalition forces in the West. And today we're going to examine why I happen to think that the increasingly ineffective and corrosive relationship with NATO needs to be revisited. Now, I am all in favor of disentanglement from alliances and partnerships planet-wide, so we will discuss that in depth during this particular episode. Housekeeping. I wanted to thank everybody who has reached out to me for both the main podcast, which is Chasing Ghost in a Regular Warfare podcast, for which War Notes, the one you are listening to right now, happens to be an excursion so that I could sneak out from under that umbrella rubric of irregular warfare and cover conventional warfare and conflict futurism to a greater extent with this particular podcast and this particular series. I am recording this the weekend before the inauguration of the new administration that is coming into office. As I have mentioned before, I am a member of neither party, nor am I a champion of either political party. I tend to try to throw my cheers and jeers at those who deserve it, regardless of their affiliation. I tend to have a philosophical allegiance with certain folks more so than not. But I'm hoping, and hope is not a method, as we were taught early on, I'm hoping that this will be a refresh, a restart, a complete recalibration of how American defense takes place in the remainder of this century, and that maybe we can lay the groundwork for something that is more rational, more well thought out, and better preparing the American military enterprise for near-peer and peer competition. By the way, I've used that phraseology, near-peer and peer, so often, but I have to say on reflection over the past few weeks, I happen to think that because of the severe degradation across the board of all the services and the sclerotic and arthritic mismanagement and behavior of the joint forces, that umbrella rubric above all the individual services going up to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And as you can reflect upon in detail, if you've listened to any of the previous episodes in my Fighting Fix Club series that I've done, America's at a nadir. America is at a very bad place, especially for the amount of money that's spent, nearly $1 trillion a year, when you include the DOE budgetary considerations and things like that, you discover we are far worse off as a country militarily in the 21st century than arguably we've been since 1945. So if you wish to get in touch with me, you can find me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. That will be in the show notes along with book recommendations from those research references that I use to put together this particular podcast episode, or maybe it reflects on previous ones that have been done. I really appreciate your support. I appreciate your not necessarily positive, but constructive comments on things that I've said, maybe superior evidence you have that may sway my position, or recommendations for future podcast episodes. And also, of course, I have a Substack, which will also be listed in the show notes. So let's get on with today's episode. And that episode is Just Say No to NATO. So let's get down to brass tacks and make sure that we're discussing in a terminological consensus just what we're discussing. We're discussing alliances and partnerships. In this case, the DoD itself calls alliances formal agreements between two or more nations in national defense. Their promises that each nation will support the other, particularly during war. For instance, in NATO, you have Article 5, which means that one invasion or threat against one member nation, in this case 32 member nations in present-day NATO, is a strike against all of them, and they all join happily in waging war on whoever that interloper may have been. Now remember, these kind of entangling alliances, which George Washington warned us about late in the 18th century, are such that it led to the catastrophe and the cavalcade of calamities that bested and wrestled down Western civilization in 1914 to engage in some of the worst warfare the planet has ever seen. And then, of course, we have the temporary truce in 1918, the interregnum between 1918 and 1933 to 1939, in which the war started to heat up yet again. It's as much as I disagree with Neil Ferguson, who I think is a creditable historian in some aspects and a brilliant writer, he's the one who wrote the book War of the World about what we're discussing here, 1914 to 1945. And his characterization is one that I happen to agree with. Some examples of alliances that the U.S. is include NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, with 32 countries. NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, with Canada. ANZUS, which is the Australia, New Zealand, and U.S. Security Treaty and the Moroccan-American Treaty of Friendship, which happens to be, by the way, America's oldest unbroken treaty. And these treaties are documents that seal the deal on these alliances. So sometimes you might hear the term treaty ally. By the way, these treaty allies and these treaties must be approved by the U.S. Senate. Things like international borders, trade rules, human rights, and even postal arrangements can also be set by these treaties. Some treaties make room to grow, as we have seen with the NATO blob ever pushing eastward and causing so many problems since 1991. And then you have partnerships. Partnerships are less formal than alliances, often called strategic partnerships. They help build relationships between nations or organizations like militaries. Like alliances, they benefit the members of the partnership, but they can be short-term and don't involve a treaty. By the way, if they don't involve a treaty, it has a much higher legal barrier to entry to engage in warfare on their behalf, if that is the case. One way the DoD, for instance, uses these partnerships is military-to-military exchanges. Presently, and this information is 2 years old, I think, there's 76 partnerships in the program, and it's growing by about 2 to 3 countries per year. For instance, when I was in the military and I was stationed in Southeast Asia on Okinawa, we would do exchanges with a number of countries there, everything from Vietnam to Australia to New Zealand, Vanuatu and Fiji and others, and what is characterized as Oceania, all of those island nations around there, and the Philippines and Indonesia and such, where we would have exchange programs for training. So our concentration in this particular episode is going to be on NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which was founded at the conclusion of World War II in 1945 and has evolved into the monstrosity that it presently is today. Presently, there are 32 member nations. You can look it up. I'm not going to read the nations off to you because most of you are probably either driving or don't want to hear that. NATO, again, I'm going to refer to their own site and how they characterize themselves. And for them, this is a political alliance. NATO promotes democratic values and enables members to consult and cooperate on defense and security-related issues. I think that Romania may take issue with that. And then you have the military, which is NATO is committed to the peaceful resolution of disputes. If diplomatic efforts fail, it has the military power to undertake crisis management operations. Now, one thing that I want to characterize for everybody, and that is this. NATO is an arrangement between these 32 nations. There is no NATO army per se. There is a NATO umbrella bureaucracy that sort of works at making sure the alliance and the coalition and the military forces train together, can speak together through communications, and has what the military would term interoperability. So most of us growing up, especially those in the military, have discovered something called a NATO standard. A NATO standard is the weapon systems, is the ammunition, are the supply modalities, are the logistics modalities, port embarkation, debarkation, are all of these arrangements made? For instance, back in the day when the Warsaw Pact gave some reason for NATO to exist before its dissolution, along with the USSR and the Warsaw Pact nations in 1989 to 1991, what you discovered is that interoperability was incredibly important for a variety of reasons. As a matter of fact, it was at that time in the 1980s when NATO discovered its conventional forces were so inferior to its perceived numerical inferiority to the Warsaw Pact forces that a first use of nuclear weapons policy was adopted in order to give those conventional forces a chance to get to the front lines when the Russians allegedly would head west. Between 1945 and 1949, many talks were engaged in to see what would happen. 1949, we officially see that NATO is engaged and becomes what it, well, actually, it would be a shadow of what it is today. But nonetheless, what we saw was that from 1949 until 1989 to 91, NATO, even from my non-interventionist philosophical perspective, did serve a salient and rational purpose in deterring, deferring, and possibly protecting well against a posited Soviet Warsaw Pact advance on Europe proper in that time period. Now, after the wall fell, and conclusively so in 1991, for me, NATO was on borrowed time. But unfortunately, if we look at these kind of things historically, what we find, and I know this is going to seem like a sideways analog, but here it is. What we saw with the Prohibition Act, the Volstead Amendment, that established that you can't drink alcohol in America between 1919 and 1933 when it sunsetted, that once that amendment was defeated conclusively, and again, folks could drink alcohol in America and do so in a lawful fashion, all of those federal agents who were employed at the time in the Department of the Treasury to fight for prohibition and to poison 20,000 Americans with addled alcohol needed a job. I will include in the show notes a couple prohibition books that I recommend every American read. And nonetheless, what we discovered is that all of these Department of Treasury agents needed a job. Hence, you have, coincidentally, at the beginning of the 1930s, the marijuana prohibitions start to take place. And with the 1934 National Firearms Act, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms becomes a going enterprise in the federal government. And then, of course, we have the DEA, which is established in the early 70s to go after, in this case, the Drug Enforcement Agency. We have an organization that was built to take the slack, as it were, of these agents who would be out of a job and give them a job. One can say, in a sideways analogy, the same thing happened here with NATO, where in 1991, within 4 years after that period of time, they should have down-selected, downplayed, and dissolved NATO. It didn't happen, and it started to expand. And promises were made between 1991 and 1995 that that expansion, that inexorable expansion eastward of NATO, would not happen. And you will discover a very interesting historiographical shift in the rhetoric by NATO since that time, in which they're denying the very history and the very quotes that are available to show that there was even resistance to the NATO expansion eastward, and that they deny it to this day. Now, the most important change that NATO has undergone since the collapse of the Berlin Wall is its outreach to the nations of the former Warsaw Pact. In an editorial published in 1990, the American historian John Lewis Gaddis recommended that both NATO and the Warsaw Pact should be preserved in post-Cold War Europe and that the two alliances should be merged into a pan-European security organization. NATO was quick to respond to this problem, reaching out to those who had previously opposed it. At its summit meeting in London in July 1990, the alliance extended the hand of friendship to all the former members of the Warsaw Pact and invited their governments and any other willing to join to establish regular contact and consultation with NATO. The following November, this would be 1990, the alliance's members and their new partner signed a joint declaration in Paris, stating that they no longer regarded each other as adversaries and would refrain henceforth from the threat of force against each other. Now, as this relationship developed, the alliance made it clear that, quote, our own security is inseparably linked to that of all other states in Europe. Remember, this is a continental domination. We do not wish to isolate any country, nor to see a new division of the continent. Our objectives is to help to create Europe whole and free. Then, the inaugural meeting of the North Atlantic Cooperation Council on 20th December 1991 marked the beginning of a new enhanced relationship and a genuine partnership between NATO and its liaison partners. George Bush Sr. made noises about this very thing. Secretary of State Baker made assurances that were echoed by a number of other officials. So during this time, there was sort of a laissez-faire attitude to what this possible expansion would look like, but it wasn't articulated in any of the documents. Now, the Foggy Bottoms intelligentsia likes to say that the main question in the context of the alleged guarantees of non-expansion of NATO to the East is whether the February 1990 assurances are a form of commitment. Now, opponents of the agreement claim they view these 1990 statements as a diplomatic maneuver by the West in order to probe the position of the Soviet leadership. Remember, this is 1990. And help it to overcome the obstacle to the unification of Germany and not as a binding agreement. This non-proliferation of NATO eastward, I would put the denouement and the tombstone for it on October 22, 1993, when Clinton's Secretary of State, Warren Christopher, told the president about the NATO Partnership for Peace program, designed for military cooperation with non-alliance states. Yeltsin, based on Christopher's words, considered that NATO had abandoned plans to expand to the east and decided to include all the countries of Eastern Europe and the CIS in the program, rather than include only some of them. Christopher later claimed that Yeltsin misunderstood him and the partnership did not exclude further accession at all. Now, mind you, this is 1993, and all of a sudden we see that these fundamental assertions of non-expansion to the east were all smoke and mirrors. And for the most part, if you were to take a look at the inexorable expansion to the east to border Ukraine and then attempt to go into Ukraine and flirt with them to enter the NATO relationships and such, that Russia was alarmed by all of this. Now, remember, when it comes to going on the Ukrainian border and such, this is a result of a number of things. That would be the color revolutions in 2008 and 2014 in the Ukraine, and more on that in another episode where I'll talk about color revolutions, most likely in the Chasing Ghosts podcast. But nonetheless, what you discover is that I don't think that the diplomatic and defense intelligentsia in America and Europe were gauging or extrapolating properly the second and third order consequences and effects of what they were trying to do by this inexorable expansion east against a Russia, which traditionally has desired to have a Western barrier and boundary buffer zone because of its 19th century and 20th century historical invasions by European neighbors into Russia proper. I came across a really interesting discussion on NATO expansion, What Gorbachev Heard, from 2017 from a National Security Archive at the, I think it's George Mason University. These declassified documents show security assurances against NATO expansion to Soviet leaders from Baker, Bush, Genscher, Kohl, Gates, Mitterrand, Thatcher, Heard, Major, and Warner. All of them. I quote from that document, quote, as late as March 1991, according to the diary of the British ambassador to Moscow, British Prime Minister John Major personally assured Gorbachev, we are not talking about the strengthening of NATO. Subsequently, when Soviet Defense Minister Marshal Dmitry Yazov asked Major, Prime Minister Major, UK, about East European leaders' interest in NATO membership, the British leader responded, quote, Nothing of the sort will happen. When Russian Supreme Soviet deputies came to Brussels to see NATO and meet with NATO Secretary General Manfred Werner in July 1991, Werner told the Russians that, quote, we should not allow the isolation of the USSR from the European community. According to Russian memorandum of conversation, Werner stressed that the NATO Council and he were against the expansion of NATO. 13 of 16 NATO members support this point of view. Remember, this is 1991. I have mentioned to you that today there are 32 members, and in this case, there were 16 members, half again as much. One Department of State memo that I found very interesting, which I will put in the show notes, is, as U.S. representatives stated in 1996, the USSR's right to discuss and establish security parameters in connection with the unification of Germany, quote, essentially limiting its sovereignty, stemmed from the supreme rights of the four victorious powers, USSR, USA, Great Britain, and France, established following the Second World War in relation to Germany, and it has not set a precedent for Russian surveillance of our Central and Eastern European states. End of quote. And what they're basically saying there is it's a backdoor legalistic fashioning where because the USSR no longer exists and it was a signatory to the limitations on what NATO's ambitions were all about, that it was no longer in play and no longer statutory law or even recognized as historically significant in the post-1991 European world. I would urge everybody also to, because of the brevity of the podcast, I can't go into all the details, but one has to look at the Partnership for Peace. You've got to look at the Euro-Atlantic Partnership Council, and you've got to look at the European Union itself out of Brussels. In all these, to lend a phrase from earlier in the podcast, the interoperable and exclusionary tactics that have been employed by Europe to do the very things that have taken the blob east and provoked so much, provoked, of course, being the title of Scott Horton's book on the Russian military invasion of the Ukraine. I highly recommend the book. I have put it in the show notes where he goes through all the DNA, the hand receipts, the footnotes, the quotes, and everything that led up to what happened there, which is directly related to this inexorable blob movement east of NATO. Now let's fast forward to 2008, where there is a cable, this will be in the show notes also, from William Burns, who I've acquainted you with in previous episodes of the podcast, who was at the time the ambassador to Moscow, who happens to be right now, until his replacement is confirmed, the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, the biggest bear in the American intelligence community. And he is the one who wrote that cable that said, Nyet means Nyet. And in that cable, and you can read it yourself if you wish, but I will condense it down to size for what it said, is he said that the Russians, in this case under Putin and all of the political leaders at the time, considered the inexorable expansion of NATO east to be a red line, and to especially be a red line if the Ukraine is flirted with or asked to join NATO in and of itself, and that as a result of the misbehavior in that very same year with the color revolution that took place in Ukraine proper, caused alarm bells to go off in the Russian political and defense intelligentsia, to include the political leadership, who made it very clear to William Burns that it was a red line for war. And then it always astounds me to see that William Burns, who had such a good read on the pulse of Russian political rhetoric and intentions at the time, who is now a man who probably has access to a tremendous and deep portfolio of insights, analytics, and sheer primary source and secondary source documentation on what makes the Russians tick in this regard. Nonetheless, he does not provide what I think is the proper explanatory framework for what provoked the Russians to invade Ukraine in this century. But I suspect to a certain extent that being in a cabinet position lobotomizes your intellectual capabilities to extrapolate the second and third order effects, and the fact that to a very large extent, planet-wide and throughout history, especially war history, Newton's third law is a stone-cold motherfucker. In this case, the West is reaping the whirlwind. As a result of that And as a result of other things such as America's concentration not on near-peer and peer conflict and skill sets, but in conducting counterinsurgency operations and insurgency and anti-guerrilla operations in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, in Syria, in the Horn of Africa, in all of these other countries throughout the world, especially in the Middle East, that it has quite literally retrograded and retarded America's capability to conduct conventional warfare. And again, and it always surprises me, and yes, I may have mentioned this in another episode, but I must bring it up again for those who have joined with me in this episode and haven't listened to the previous ones. It is absolutely astonishing to me that the defense and intelligence organizations in the West approved the dispersal and acquisition and deployment and employment of all of these exquisite platforms to include the integrated air and missile defense systems, everything from Javelins to Patriots to THAADs and to all the other missile systems and manned tanks and F-16 and such, send them into this cauldron, the first one in the 21st century between peer competitors, and one can call the Ukraine and Russia fight a fight between peer competitors in this case, and to provide the Russians, who are very able students of warfare for a variety of reasons, this open-air laboratory that lets them take notes on the tactics, techniques, and procedures that's used by the West with its armories, arsenals, inventories, soldiering, air forces, the whole gamut of it for the world to see, and especially in this case, the Russians and by extension the BRICS countries with whom they are allied, such as Iran, China, and all the rest, and provide them with this laboratory in which they can perfect their A2AD, their anti-air and area denial technologies and things like that, sharing it with the Chinese and such. Extraordinary. I think that historians in the future, two, three, four decades down the line, will go down and scratch their heads and ask themselves why, with an incipient conflict with Russia, the saber rattling is evident everywhere, being almost desired by the West, why would you show your hand in such a comprehensive and distinctive fashion by deploying all of your exquisite ground and air combat modalities to your future foe? I don't have all the answers. I have some rhetorical answers, which is that I think that the West has a habit of, again, not extrapolating second and third order effects very well of what they do. So if I personally was a NATO skeptic in the 90s, my NATO skepticism has probably amped exponentially by Richter scale increases in the 21st century with the absolute incompetence, immorality, and I would say martial malpractice demonstrated by NATO forces on the ground in Europe proper and the Middle East and Iraq and Afghanistan particularly. I can tell you from personal experience being on the ground in Afghanistan for nearly 2 years and working with coalition forces and spending my last year there on a Dutch-German base and working closely with NATO allies that when it comes to combat arms, they're not very talented. When it comes to combat arms support and service support, they have their talents, but they will always be the junior partners in this alliance, with America being the Leviathan and the behemoth in logistical expertise, combat arms support, and combat arms efficacy and effectiveness. That's all American. It certainly isn't the Europeans. And there's severe interoperability problems due to language, due to lack of standardizing everything, in spite of the fact that they pay a lot of lip service to that. So my experience on the ground, while this is anecdotal, is that they don't work very well together. ComNavOps, who runs Navy Matters, a blog that I've been reading for years, one of my favorite navalists besides Commander Salamander out there in the World Wide Web, this is January 17th, I think he published it, yeah, Friday. The title of this is Get the U.S. Out of NATO, and I wanted to read from it. Quote, NATO once served a valid purpose and did so admirably. The purpose, however, is long gone with it. NATO's reason for existence, or at least the U.S. reason for remaining a member of NATO. Unfortunately, the mere mention of the faintest possibility of the U.S. existing NATO seems to trigger angst and panic among so many observers in Europe and the U.S. Panic among European observers is especially ironic given that so many in Europe despise the U.S. to begin with and work to actively undermine and obstruct any U.S. action or desire. And he says, let's examine some of the arguments against the U.S. pulling out of NATO. Isolation. Many seem to feel that pulling out of NATO would automatically lead us to the U.S. being isolationist on the world stage. This is ridiculous. Aside from erasing our name from a piece of paper, we're just talking about removing our military presence from Europe. We would still have extensive and intimate financial, trade, cultural, and scientific interactions. End of quote. My comment on this is that I don't consider it isolation. I consider it non-intervention. If you want to look at isolation, you would look at the kind of protectionism that is practiced by countries like China to a small extent and Mexico to a larger extent, where they are genuinely isolationist and that they want no interaction with the rest of the world. Now, what you find, for instance, with the non-interventionist strategy is that it does cause our European allies to fill their pants because they don't foot the bill for the freeloading that they participated in since 1949 with NATO, where America has spent the most money, exported the most arms, and maintained the largest bases and combat arms facility on the continent, combat arm facilities on the continent. He goes on, Russian threat. This argument has been forever laid to rest by the Ukraine war. If a single small country with almost no military to begin with, the war and a population a quarter the size of Russia can fight Russia to a standstill, albeit with significant munitions resupply help from the West, then the Russian threat is overblown to the point of irrelevance. End of quote. This is where I part ways with ComNavOps, respectfully so, in which I think that the Russians are possibly and probably the preeminent conventional war peer competitor on planet Earth. And despite all the infusions from dozens of countries of arms and money and support and such to Ukraine, they are on their last legs as we speak. To quote again from him, political balance. Some suggest that the U.S. presence balances political and territorial ambitions among the European countries, as if our absence from NATO would trigger all-out wars between European countries. This seems patently absurd, if for no other reason than the European countries don't have much in the way of extensive or effective militaries, as evidenced by their very low defense expenditure levels and nearly non-existent munitions inventories. End of quote. He is correct in this. The NATO midgets, when it comes to their militaries, don't have much to show for themselves. I think with the UK, for instance, from a naval perspective, they have less than 35 operable capital ships. They have two new conventionally powered carriers that shouldn't find themselves in blue water very much away from England because their propulsion systems consistently break down since 2017. If one were to take the British Army and one were to take the Royal Commandos and one were to take the Royal Marines and combine those three once august forces together, you would be lucky to find 10,000 trigger pullers in the entirety of the British Army. The British Army itself, above and beyond trigger pullers, numbers at something like 75,000 in the UK today, a shadow of its former self. The French happen to suffer from some of the same numbers when it comes to degradation of trigger pullers. I think the French Foreign Legion total strength is over 10,000, but they have one regiment, which let's conservatively call it 2,000 soldiers, is permanently assigned to protecting the European Space Agency organization in Latin America, and they are deployed there forever. He goes on, mutual military support, quote, the contention is that the U.S. would lose the military cooperation and support of European countries and access to bases. Well, any country can assist the U.S. at any time and in any way they choose without the U.S. needing to be part of NATO. The reality, however, is that all too often European countries always refuse to assist the U.S. militarily. Overflight permissions have been refused during U.S. actions, and foreign ships have pulled out of U.S. naval task forces when the possibility of U.S. action has risen. This is evident in the Red Sea in the past 18 months in the fight against Yemen. Sometimes foreign countries assist us and sometimes they don't. They have their political objectives and we have ours. Short of invoking Article 5 of the NATO agreement, nothing would change the degree of cooperation with the U.S., end of quote. He is correct in all of this, and consistently, the NATO allies have been not only a fair-weather friend, but militarily ineffective at the large level. He goes on, defense of Europe, quote, some seem to think that the U.S. is not a member of NATO. That precludes the U.S. from helping to defend Europe. This is absurd. If Europe is threatened, the U.S. will most certainly step in to help, treaty or no treaty. It's in our best interest. End of quote. I don't quite agree with that. I do think that the increasing Sovietization and the literal communism practiced by the European Union out of Brussels is just a sight to behold in the 21st century, where one can look back at the 20th century and discover that central planning, large, unwieldy coalition arrangements like the EU will meet their end as a result of political overreach. And I think that's what we're witnessing as we speak. And I'm quoting from this to show you that while ComNavOps and I have common purpose in most things, we don't have common purpose in all things, to show you that there are a variety of EU and NATO skeptics out there, whether they hail from the traditional left or the traditional right, whatever may be the case. But in the end, we all agree, for the various reasons that we bring to the table, that membership in NATO is not effective, and that in my mind, it is neutral or deleterious to the national security primacy, if not safety, of the United States proper. Now, he examines the options. Quote, an option for those too queasy about the U.S. formally pulling out of NATO is that the U.S. could simply pull out of Europe while remaining a member of NATO. Nothing that I'm aware of obligates us to be physically present on the continent. This would allow all the resources currently devoted to Europe to be redirected at the real threat, which is China. Another option would be to use U.S. withdrawal from NATO as a major bargaining chip in a Ukraine-Russia peace settlement. For example, the U.S. might agree to withdraw from NATO if Russia returns Crimea and returns to pre-war borders and the Ukraine is granted NATO membership. End of quote. There's a variety of things that I want to tease out of what he says here. And one of the things he says is this would allow all the resources currently devoted to Europe to be redirected at the real threat, which is China. I don't consider China a military threat. I consider it a regional hegemon that is consistently employing soft power around the world and consistently employing hard power next to its country. In this case, China has zero history of extraterritorial military success in its entire history. And naysayers will say to me, well, Bill, Japan in 1870 had not invaded a single other nation. This is correct. There were two giant invasions launched against Japan that both failed. One among them was the Mongols. And then all of a sudden, 1870, we see this miraculous reinvention of itself in Japan, where they forced themselves into the modern age, and they forced themselves into the 20th century in this case. And in a matter of generations, they're able to field a navy that is second to none planet-wide until 1942, of course, in Midway, which changes the course of the entire conflict. But as I've mentioned before, when one looks at December 1941 through April 1942 and the Japanese centrifugal strategy that was employed, and remember, this is from basically a very isolationist nation prior to 1870, takes the Dutch, takes the U.S., takes the Australians, takes the British, and takes the French out of Southeast Asia entirely. And it takes the U.S. and its allies literally years to get that back. When ComNavOps talks about another option would be to use the U.S. withdrawal as a major bargaining chip for Ukraine-Russia peace settlement, I'm all in favor of that, not for the reasons that he articulates, but for the reason that if the U.S. were to withdraw from NATO tomorrow morning or maybe Tuesday morning, after the new administration takes office, there would be no greater impetus for the EU and Brussels and NATO to immediately rush to the bargaining table in Geneva and carve out a deal. As far as the Crimea being repatriated back to the Ukrainians, I don't see that in the card, not only because of what 2008 and William Burns memo elucidated about the Russian need to stop the NATO blob in its inexorable march east, but also that Russia, for the remainder of humanity's history, will always seek a buffer state to its western provinces. And he concludes, quote, "There is no valid argument for the U.S. remaining in NATO and every reason for the U.S. to leave NATO. The world faces an extreme threat from China, and U.S. resources need to be focused on that threat and not babysitting a Europe that faces no realistic threat. It is past time for Europe to stand on its own," end of quote. I disagree with that pivoting from Europe to China. I think that what the United States actually needs to do is to leave NATO, leave CETO, leave the partnerships, leave these alliances, and refresh, recalibrate, and take a knee and take a determination on what these things do to prejudice or endanger American homeland national security. Look, we just came from a lovely vacation in Croatia. I highly recommend that any of my listeners who have not been to Europe, take a trip to Europe. Don't go to the UK. Take a trip to Europe. And we were just in Croatia for over 2 weeks. What a lovely country for so many reasons. 95% Catholic, very homogenous. I wouldn't say they're militaristic, but I would say they're a hardy people. They're very proud of their heritage. I was able to tread and walk on streets that the Romans had built. I was able to go to Austro-Hungarian forts. I was able to meet with locals and folks that we met there, delightfully so, who were living in stuff that had been built by the Italians and the Venetian Republic over 500 years ago and was still standing. They have a highway system there that is second to none. I mean, it's on par with any highway system one would find in the United States, for instance, where we have a very sophisticated road infrastructure. Again, anecdotal, they had joined the EU, they had joined NATO, and they regretted it. They resented it, and they had nothing good to say about EU treatment of Croatia nor NATO treatment of Croatia. Now, when I had been in Afghanistan, one of the reasons I went to Croatia was because I had friends in Afghanistan who were with Croatian Special Forces, who I worked with and went outside the wire with. We had a tremendously good time and perilous times on very few occasions. I was really impressed by those folks. So again, it's these kind of friendship relations that can blossom into visiting their countries. They always urged me to come out and visit, and I did. And no regrets. Wonderful. And I speak from the people's perspective there, but when one looks at either opinion pieces or the political hit pieces that are coming out of Europe, you name the country, and they don't have a lot of good things to say about Americans. And I do think that when it comes to those 80 military bases in Europe, with the majority of those located in Germany, Italy, and the United Kingdom, it's hard to get an exact number on this because it's going to vary on how base itself, that word, is defined. The largest base is Ramstein Air Base in Germany. The command structure is the U.S. European Command, which oversees all U.S. military operations there. You've got U.S. Army in Europe and Africa. You've got U.S. Naval Forces Europe and Africa. You've got U.S. Air Forces Europe and Africa, and a number of other ones. As of July 2024, 128 military bases in 55 countries and territories. Some of those are NATO-led that are outside of it, respectively. I can tell you, again, there's a lot of complaints of U.S. bases being based in countries. For instance, I was stationed in Okinawa, Japan for 3 years, and the number of folks, again, anecdotal, who would tell me that we wish you would leave, and I do believe that we should leave Germany, we should leave Japan, we should leave South Korea. Look, there are a variety of reasons to leave these countries, among which is they are militarily and politically crippled when America has large bases in their countries, such as Japan and South Korea and Germany, because it speaks to the freeloader problem where they won't domestically produce a military core power acquisition system, deployment and employment capability, because they can always rely on Uncle Sam to provide what they can save themselves money on and save the political capital that it would take to do that very thing by getting out of there. I think that our position in South Korea, having been there a considerable number of times in uniform, is a place that we should leave immediately. The South Koreans are more than able to provide for their own defense. The same applies, of course, to the Japanese. The same applies to the Philippines when we're speaking to this region that is outside the second and third island chains outside of China. When one goes to Germany, there seems to be expansion now where that center of gravity is going to shift from Germany to Poland and such and get closer and closer to Russia, which I think for a variety of reasons is rather provocative. I do wish that there was some kind of impact statement that some worthy could come up with that would say, of all of these hundreds of bases around the world, but if you wanted to confine yourself to Europe, South Korea, and Japan, how much does it cost in the end? How much does it cost the United States? And we're also talking about the fact that if you leave Japan and you leave South Korea, there is a territory called Guam in which there are a lot of forward deployed refueling bomber and fighter air force entities along with ports for navies and things like that. America has unclassified bases all over the place that one could track. I'm certain that the number of classified bases or modalities is probably quite numerous to include embassies and consulates and such that have small numbers who are basing themselves out of there as either military attaches or covert employees of the intelligence community. I mean, all this talk of Greenland in the headlines of late, there are approximately 150 people at the Patufik Space Base that the U.S. Space Force has. It's the U.S. Space Force's northernmost base in Greenland proper. The base is home to a substantial portion of the global network of missile warning sensors of Space Delta 4 and space surveillance and space control centers of Space Delta 2, providing space awareness and advanced missile detection capabilities of NORAD. These Delta organizations is not like CAG or Delta that you've seen in the movies in Hollywood and that you're aware of participating in hostage rescue. These are United States Space Force units responsible for providing strategic and theater missile warning and tracking to the United States, along with satellite coverage and things like that. I wanted to close with one of my favorite paleo conservatives, and that would be Patrick Joseph Buchanan, who is now 83 years of age. This was published in 2022. Title is, Where Does NATO Enlargement End? Quote, after the Berlin Wall fell in 1989 and the Warsaw Pact dissolved, the breakup of the USSR began. But the dissolution did not stop with the 14 Soviet republics declaring their independence of Moscow. Decomposition had only just begun. Transnistria broke away from Moldova, South Ossetia and Abkhazia seceded from Georgia, Chechnya broke free of Russia, but was restored to Moscow's control after two savage wars. Crimea and the Donbas were severed from Ukraine. Besides these post-Cold War amputations assisted by Russia, what do Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia have in common? All seek admission to NATO, and with it, Article 5 war guarantees that oblige the United States to wage war against Russia to restore their sovereignty and territorial integrity if attacked. It is easy to understand why these nations would want the U.S. obligated to fight on their behalf. What is not understandable is why the U.S. would issue such war guarantees. Why would we commit to risk war with a nuclear-armed Russia on behalf of nations no one has ever regarded as vital interests of the United States of America? Consider how many nations have been admitted to NATO and thus received U.S. war guarantees after 1991. These are 14: Czechia, Slovakia, Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, Poland, Slovenia, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Albania, Croatia, Montenegro, and North Macedonia. These 14 newest members of NATO represent an expansion of U.S. war commitments riskier in ways than the original creation of NATO, when we were obligated to defend 10 nations of Western Europe. Today, we defend 29 nations stretching to Eastern Europe. End of quote. I just wanted to infer there that there are now 32 nations, as I mentioned earlier in this episode. What I'm reading from was from 2022. My, how time passes quickly. Again, quote, still further NATO expansion may be in the cards. As mentioned, Georgia and Ukraine are looking to join NATO and have the U.S. thereby obligated to fight Russia in their defense. Two other nations, Sweden and Finland, are talking of abandoning their traditional neutrality for NATO membership in U.S. war guarantees. Editors note, both of those things have occurred already. Bosnia and Herzegovina, I served in those, is also a candidate member of NATO. Its capital is Sarajevo, where an assassin's bullet fired in 1914 killed the Austrian Archduke, an incident that led directly to the First World War. Mikhail Gorbachev, at the end of the Cold War, repeatedly told U.S. Secretary of State James Baker, as I alluded to earlier, that Russia would agree to unification of East and West Germany if the U.S.